Many things that I was going to talk about have already been covered very nicely in multiple earlier talks in the last couple days. But I will give you my take on a few things, and I also want to talk about a mixture of what, from my perspective, is old work that started over 2 years ago when Pavel and Andreas Karsh and I started thinking about this issue of drag exerted on a heavy quark moving through an N equals 4 plasma. We started thinking about that. We sort of got stalled. Kritz Herzog arrived in Seattle sort of a year later, and we started making much more rapid progress. So I want to talk a little bit about work that is now more than a year old, but then I also want to spend some time on some much more recent work I've done with my student, Paul Chesler, in this past year. Okay, so given Uli's nice talk, I really won't say anything about the motivation, the big picture, heavy ion collisions, evidence for strongly coupled plasmas, but there's my little caricature sketch. I won't say anything about experimental probes, and in particular jet quenching, and the reasons for being interested in the energy loss of a high energy quark that could either be a light quark or a heavy quark propagating through some strongly coupled plasma. I won't say anything about apologizing for now switching from QCD to a fake theory, N equals 4, except to remind you that if it weren't for the tools that have been provided by gauge string duality or ADS-CFT, we basically have no good techniques for probing dynamical questions in strongly coupled non-equilibrium gauge theories. Even though it already has been covered, I'll at least say a few words that purporting to use N equals 4 to learn about properties of QCD is either a really stupid idea or at least a potentially interesting idea, depending on what properties you're interested in. If you're interested in zero temperature physics, this works pretty poorly, since N equals 4 doesn't even have particles. Of course, there are deformations of the N equals 4 theory that are much more QCD-like, but the simplest maximally supersymmetric theory doesn't even have particles. But everything I'm going to talk about, and much of what we've heard about in the last couple days, is focusing on the thermal case, where I just want to stress once again that at a qualitative level, they're really very similar. They're both non-abelian plasmas. They both have the physics of device screening. They both have a finite spatial correlation length. Their large distance, large time response is described by neutral fluid hydrodynamics. The qualitative level, changing the specific matter content from gluons plus fundamental representations to gluons plus fundamental representation quarks to gluons plus adjoint representation fermions and scalars just isn't a big deal. That doesn't answer the question how similar they are quantitatively, but at least it says it's an interesting thing to try and understand. Okay. We already heard from Dan Sun this morning a nice introduction to the whole setting of ADS-CFT duality and its applications to thermal physics, so I won't say anything more about his and others' initial applications to quantities like transport coefficients. I think I will say a little bit more about the setup for being able to ask questions about heavy quarks in N equals 4. So I really want to think about heavy quarks as arbitrarily heavy test particles. I'm adding them to the theory. I'm then going to watch their dynamics. On the gravitational side, what I'm really doing is adding a D7 brain that is embedded in the ADS black hole cross S5 geometry. In this particular slice, it looks like the D7 brain fills ADS space from the boundary down to some minimal position. That minimal position is directly related to the mass of the heavy quarks, strictly speaking, of the full N equals 2 hypermultiplet that we've added to N equals 4 super Yang Mills. So the whole purpose of that, adding that D-brain, is so you then have open strings that can end on that D-brain. And in the thermal context, where there's a black hole with horizon, that immediately gives you these two different categories of possible string solutions. You have open strings with two endpoints on the D-brain, and those will have a natural interpretation as quark, anti-quark, meson-like configurations. And you also have configurations with a string with one endpoint on the D-brain and the other end hidden behind the black hole horizon. And I hope everybody already appreciates that this ADS radial coordinate, and I'll always draw pictures this way with the boundary of ADS space up here and the black hole horizon down there, there really is this very physical interpretation connecting where you are radially in ADS space with the energy scale at which the dynamics you're looking at is taking place in the dual field theory. So high energy dynamics takes place up here, low energy dynamics takes place down closer to the horizon. Right? Which is why changing the lower radius of the D-brain so that it ends, if I push the boundary of that D-brain upward, that's the same as increasing the mass of the heavy quark. If I bring it downward, that's decreasing the mass of the heavy quark. Okay. So the wonderful thing about this application of ADS-CFT duality is you're mapping what is truly a hideously complicated quantum field theory problem that is finite temperature, you have all the physics of thermal fluctuations, it's a quantum field theory, you have all the physics of quantum fluctuations, it's strongly coupled into something which is basically classical physics, just happens to take place in this curved ten-dimensional space-time, but all the action is in five dimensions. So, as I guess several people, Steve Gupser and Garrettini already talked about, if you now want to study dynamics of a heavy quark in this framework, it's the same thing as understanding dynamics of an open string ending on this D-brain, and in the limit of a large number of colors and a large value of the Tuff coupling, that's the limit in which it's sufficient to just do classical string dynamics. So all you need is to know what the geometry of your space-time is, what the simplest non-Bugodo action of the string is, go ahead, vary it, get equations of motion, turn it into some, you know, freshman physics, solve this differential equation problem. And if you happen to focus your attention on string world sheets that just lie in a plane, so that's physically going to be describing the quark that's just moving in one direction at all times, then the equations of motion boil down to a simple 1 plus 1 dimensional wave equation. There it is. And the simplest solutions are trivial, but I'll spend a moment on them before talking about interesting solutions. The most trivial solution is, of course, one where the string is completely static, just sits there, hangs straight down from the D-brain to the horizon. It doesn't do anything other than it lets you evaluate its energy. And its energy changes depending on the temperature. I guess I needed to say changing the temperature is the same thing as changing the radial position of the horizon of the D-brain. So if you increase the temperature, that horizon moves out in the ADS geometry, and then that decreases the length of the string that you see here. A simple calculation gives you a thermal correction to the mass of this heavy quark, which happens to be 1/2 square root lambda t, and is negative.
Larry, do you understand from a field theory perspective why a thermal correction to heavy quark has to be negative?
I believe so, but if you will, could we talk about it afterwards? Let me just say that I think most people are probably most familiar with the story of thermal mass corrections to massless degrees of freedom, which are always positive. You increase the effective mass. The heavy quark is different, and in essence, it's really just the physics of screening the color field around that.
The screening charge of the
Yeah, but when you're talking about heavy quark, it's essentially the source of your gluon field, right? Because mm-hmm. you're not considering the dynamics of it, right? So it's like fixing in some special way boundary conditions for gauge field, right?
It's a source for the gauge field.
Yeah. So in this way, you can say formulate in terms of gauge fields themselves, right? In principle, because your heavy quark does give you.
Yeah. And if you just look at the static solution, that's basically all you're learning about.
I mean, it's also the same story, it's just exchange correlation energy changes sign. If you go from light fragments to heavy fragments, it's the same effect.
Mm-hmm. Because it's a lengthy thing.
Yeah. But somehow, some of us spent so long only thinking about the dynamics of light particles, it seems strange to see this difference.
Why is this heavy quark in the extra dimension? It's not.
In the ordinary space. Oh, it is.
It is.
So it's both. So in all my pictures, maybe I also need to say this, right? Ordinary space-time, I mean, think of what I'm drawing as a horizontal direction as one of our ordinary spatial dimensions. So the location of the quark in four-dimensional space-time is really the same thing as saying what is the coordinates of the endpoint of that string in the four asymptotically Minkowski directions.
So you have this seventh dimension is sticking out somewhere else.
Well, so you have the ADS-5 geometry, right, which is a five-dimensional space-time. It has a boundary whose geometry looks just like Minkowski space. So think of it as Minkowski space to which we've added one new dimension, which is what I'm calling and drawing as this radial dimension. Right? There's another five dimensions wrapped up in this S5 you can completely forget about. Okay, so the only physics out of that is simply a calculation of this thermal mass correction, and that will be useful.
Anyone think of this? Correction is just the side, the energy which is, or the free energy which is within this
precisely. This is the change in the free energy of the system induced by inserting that heavy quark, and it's changed because you screen what would otherwise be the normal Coulomb field.
The correct sign of the dependence.
Yes.
You can often calculate tuning in around it in the same way that which was calculated.
Okay, but now let's look for solutions where the quark is moving. Okay, so let's do dynamics. Statics is boring. One can look at a string configuration, which is exactly the same straight string, and now just rigidly translate it at some velocity v. If you look at the equations of motion that I just wrote, and if you're a little bit cavalier about just dividing common factors from that equation, you could lead yourself to think that this is a solution of the equations of motion, but it's completely sick. It's an unphysical solution. Steve talked about, there's a point in the interior of that ADS geometry where the signature of the induced metric on the string world sheet is changing sign. That really means that the square root of its determinant is developing an imaginary part. And suffice to say, it's simply not physics.
But say, if the temperature would be zero, then this P would be not observable, right?
So, good question. So, yeah, if you crank the temperature down to zero,
yeah,
then you don't have a point here where the induced metric becomes degenerate. There's no problem. It's a perfectly fine solution, as of course it must be, because at zero temperature, it's just a boost of the static solution.
Zero temperature was the meaning of the string that ends in a middle of ADS 6.
Well, it doesn't end. It goes all the
way. It
goes all the way. There is no horizon.
And
it goes all the way.
I mean, think in global coordinates from one part of the domain.
Okay, so, but it's just a free point in another panel. It goes all the way.
It goes all the way.
Okay.
Let's turn up the temperature from zero and make your question go away.
But yeah, I mean, you do have. Because I think it's an important, but obvious physical point that if you do have zero temperature and you have a degree 7 right here, then you can hang a string for it, hang a string from it, call it a B for it, and say that it's just moving along and it's doing it.
Right, but if you say, what's the other end of that string? I mean, it can fall down in the geometry in some sense forever. It's a non-confining theory, and it's perfectly reasonable to just have a free, have the quark added to it. Okay, but with the temperature turned on, there is that black hole horizon. Then that string can't be hanging down if it's moving. And the simplest sensible moving solution you can look for is one where you just say, by fiat, let's look for a solution that's stationary in time. So the only time dependence is just that the entire profile of the string, whatever it is, just moves along at a constant velocity. So that amounts to saying, find some string world sheet where the position in this direction as a function of the radial distance just has this simple form here. A universal profile function that I'm writing as x of u plus just velocity times time. All right, looking for a stationary solution immediately changes that 1 plus 1 dimensional wave equation down to an ordinary differential equation. It has a trivial first integral. You go ahead and integrate it, just as Phil talked about in detail. And here is the solution for the choice of integration constant that gives you a sensible string world sheet that stretches all the way from the boundary arbitrarily close to the horizon. There's obviously one sign ambiguity because you get to take a square root. So there's really two solutions. One of them looks like this, naturally referred to as the trailing string solution. You have a quark moving along in some direction, and it looks like its string is just some tail that it's dragging behind it. But the equations, the dynamics, are time reversal invariant. There is another solution that amounts to a quark somehow pushing this infinitely long tail ahead of it instead of dragging it behind it. I think anybody looking at that would have a clear suspicion that this makes sense and that doesn't. If you calculate what energy or momentum is doing, it's also very clear that in this solution, you have a constant flow of energy and momentum going down the string toward the black hole horizon. And in contrast, in this other solution, you have energy and momentum flowing away from the black hole horizon. Okay, so.
Is it boundary Marshall? Boundary Marshall means V also goes in the other direction, or not?
No, I would change V at all times.
It's something else to do, so.
You reverse that, so you reverse time and just flip it.
Ah, you just flip the.
Yes, thank you. It is still time reversal that relates these solutions. In terms of my pictures, that's about it. Okay, calculating the rate at which energy and momentum flows down the string is a simple exercise that, again, as we heard just this morning, involves evaluating the what's really the energy momentum flux on the string world sheet. If you just express the answer in terms of the velocity which with this whole string is moving, these are the results for the rate at which either energy or momentum flows down the string. If you look at that, well, in particular, if you focus on the rate of change of momentum and you see something which is velocity divided by square root 1 minus v squared, any of us should look at that and say, oh, that just looks like momentum divided by mass in special relativity. So if I just write things in terms of momentum instead of velocity, this is really an extremely simple relation for the rate at which the quark is losing energy. If you happen to phrase that as the rate per unit distance traveled, then it's exactly the same thing as the rate per unit time at which it's losing momentum, and it's just some universal number times momentum. Now, we have momentum flowing down the string at a constant rate. That means at the upper endpoint, something has to be feeding momentum into this string. And a rate of change of momentum per unit time is, by definition, a force. So this is just saying that there is a constant force acting on the endpoint of that string, dragging it along, and that you need that force in order to keep its velocity constant, because we've so far only looked for a constant velocity solution. So in other words, calculating the momentum flow down the string really is exactly the same thing as calculating the drag force that's trying to make the quark slow down. And that's exactly the same thing as calculating the external force that must be equal and opposite in order to keep the quark moving at a constant velocity. So in this simplest gravitational dual theory, maximally supersymmetric n equals 4, you get this friction coefficient that has this simple form, goes like square root of lambda t squared. In converting an expression written in terms of velocity to an expression written in terms of momentum, I actually needed to put in some understanding of what the relation is between momentum and velocity, and that means I need to put in some understanding of what the effective mass of this excitation is. And this is a non-trivial subtle point, because we're in a thermal system. There's a crisp, well-defined answer to the question, what is the zero temperature mass of this heavy quark? But there's no reason that that's the mass that should appear in describing its dynamics in a thermal context. Of course, if this quark is arbitrarily heavy, if I send its zero temperature mass to infinity, then any thermal corrections are bound to be negligible. It's clear that in the arbitrarily heavy quark mass limit, I don't really need to worry about whether this is some thermal mass or just the zero temperature mass. But if I bring down the mass of that heavy quark, I will need to pay attention to that.
What's the magnitude of T in relation to temperature when it
supplies? Let me come to that in just a little bit, if I could. OK, so this is giving you the rate of change at which energy or momentum is flowing along the string. A different question that's natural, seemingly, is to just say you have this string, calculate its total energy. That's also an easy question, which gives you a simple answer of infinity. And maybe I shouldn't admit it, but when we first got this solution and we first calculated and we first got infinity, we said, well, the UV side is no problem. That if you really integrate the energy of that string all the way to the boundary, you do get a UV divergent result. But if I really have test quarks of arbitrarily large but finite mass, then as I showed in my picture, that brings in the endpoint of the D7 brain on which that string can end to some finite value in the ADS geometry, and that cuts off that UV divergence. This is nothing other than just saying there is, for a heavy quark in a thermal system, there's a contribution to its mass, which is its zero temperature mass, and if you send that mass to infinity, its total energy goes to infinity. Completely boring, uninteresting. But the total string energy is also infrared divergent. And we were puzzled by that for a while. If you cut off the total energy some radial distance outside the black hole horizon, then that infrared divergence looks like a logarithmic divergence. But if you just draw a nice picture, then it also has a completely simple interpretation. I can write that infrared divergence, if I just cut off the lower endpoint of my string someplace, I could write things in terms of the radial distance at which I cut it off. But given the profile of the string, I can also relate that to the horizontal distance over which this tail is dragging. And this logarithmic infrared sensitivity is nothing other than a linear sensitivity in time or in distance travel. And this is obvious freshman physics that never should have confused anyone. We have a stationary solution which is describing forced motion of a heavy quark. So we're doing work on it at a constant rate, and it's been moving forever, and therefore we've been feeding energy into it forever, and therefore the total energy that we've added to the system is unbounded.
Remember, I told you that you're a pilot of the plane, and you have gasoline on
the plane. Can you talk?
Can you use it back? Because you said that you have time cinetic sensor where energy goes out, right? Or can you use it to cool a black hole?
If you could somehow prepare this time reverse solution, I guess the answer would be yes, but I have no idea.
No, but then it could be spontaneous, right? Because if it's a kind of instability of the system, right? The system would like to emit energy this way. No, because for this inverse solution, right?
If I look at a supernova back at dead time, I see a black hole explode up into the star.
Yeah.
And then maybe do that.
Right, but maybe it's a way of exploding, okay?
I mean, you can run your movie backwards, but it doesn't mean you can get the real world to do that. Okay, this stationary solution, which was also found by Steve, which has now been examined, studied by quite a few other people. There's lots of follow-on papers, in particular looking at variants of the story where you deform the theory, you deform the geometry. It is, in some sense, the easiest solution to look at because it's stationary. But that certainly doesn't mean that it's the only solution that you can or should be interested in. Before talking about just rolling up sleeves and looking for solutions with sort of highly non-trivial time dependence, one thing that one can do that we did is to just think about very late time behavior of unforced motion of a heavy quark in the system. So don't exert this external force on it. Start a quark off moving, it's going to lose energy, there's friction, it's going to slow down. At very late times, it'll be moving arbitrarily slowly. And therefore, at very late times, I can think about its configuration as a small perturbation of the trivial static configuration. In other words, you can now just do perturbation theory. You can look at fluctuations, time-dependent fluctuations, around the static solution. And that's an easy linearized analysis, because you have these boundary conditions that involve a black hole horizon, where the physically appropriate boundary condition is that things can flow in but not out, when you actually look at small fluctuations, you get what are called quasi-normal modes, which means they don't have to be real frequencies, they can be discrete points in the complex frequency plane. I don't think I want to go into the details of that at any length, except to say if you just look at the lowest frequency quasi-normal mode, you get out a nice relation between that frequency and the mass of the quark that you put in. And if you just sort of repackage that in a nicer way, what that's really giving you information about is corrections to the thermal dispersion relation. So you're looking here at motion of a quark that's moving very slowly. So if you say, how should its energy depend on its momentum? Well, it will surely have a nice expansion due to rotation invariance and powers of p squared. And it's completely natural to call the order zero term a thermal rest energy, and to call the order p squared term, write it as p squared over twice a mass. But the mass that's in the denominator here has no reason to be the same as a thermal rest mass. We don't have Lorentz invariance in a medium. There's nothing at all wrong with this mass that I'll call a kinetic mass being different from a thermal rest mass. And out of this quasi-normal mode calculation, you get a result for the two. I might just note for later use that even though this is the only thing that you truly have justified from the quasi-normal mode analysis, you're perfectly free to take an expression of this form and rewrite it in something that has sort of a natural relativistic looking square root of p squared plus kinetic mass squared, and then just an additive shift.
Is there imaginary part?
This analysis gives you no imaginary part at all. It's just giving you the real part.
But just a dumb question. So the static one is a string hanging straight down.
Yes.
It's moving with any velocity. It's trailing as this infinitely long trailing string. So how is that a small perturbation? Just the string hanging straight down?
This is a good question, which gets a little bit technical. So almost everywhere, as you look at that string hanging straight down, in the limit of arbitrarily small velocity, this moving solution that you're constructing from the quasi-normal mode is an arbitrarily small perturbation almost everywhere as you go down along that string. It is true that for any given value of the amplitude of this mode sufficiently close to the horizon, there is a region where you can question whether the linearized analysis is adequate. We could discuss that more deeply, and I'll just say for right now that I believe there's no reason to really be concerned about that. Yes?
It seems to be possible that if you pass to finite frequency instead of a DC effect,
then you won't. Exactly. And a sort of related aspect of that I'll come to in just a moment. I do just want to say, if you just look at the output, what do you see? Here I've plotted the thermal masses, either the rest mass or the kinetic mass. I happen to plot it in units of a half square root lambda t versus the zero temperature mass. So when the zero temperature mass is arbitrarily heavy, both the thermal rest mass and the kinetic mass should be very close to it, and they absolutely are. Both lines just go up here and approach a 45 degree slope. But they come down, they come below that zero temperature mass, and as you see here in the curves, the rest mass gets much smaller. The thermal rest mass gets much smaller than the zero temperature mass as this ratio here approaches one. And there's actually a sharp end to those lines, as you crank down the mass of your heavy quark, that corresponds to moving the edge of this D7 grain downward in the ADS geometry. But it's not just a trivial linear relation between the two. You actually have to solve for the dynamics of that D-brain to answer how does it want to be embedded in this curved space-time. And when you do that, you find that as you crank down the mass of the quark, that D-brain edge comes down closer and closer to the horizon until you reach a critical value of the mass that's just slightly above this 1/2 root lambda t. I forget, by a handful of percent. And if you crank the mass below that critical value, instead of the edge of the D-brain just smoothly moving down a little bit more, it suddenly jumps to being inside the black hole horizon. So there's a, if you will, a first-order phase transition as a function of the heavy quark mass. Now, everything I'm going to talk about today is using classical dynamics of a string. Good point. And so I have nothing to say about dynamics when the edge of that D-brain moves inside the horizon and you don't actually see a nice classical string hanging in the geometry. Okay. So maybe I won't have as much trouble as I thought filling up the allotted time. I do just want to say very briefly, you certainly can go ahead and solve the full 1 plus 1 dimensional time dependent equations of motion. And a particularly interesting physical case to think about is instead of looking at a single quark whose string has to fall all the way down to the horizon, look at what is arguably even more physical, which is a quark-antiquark pair. Imagine creating a quark-antiquark moving back to back with some initial momenta that is total momentum zero, but individual momentum for each one of them, whatever you want, they're going to separate. But they're in this thermal medium, they're both going to slow down. What happens? Right. Actually, solving that numerically has some subtleties, which Chris Herzog could spend time talking about in detail. I won't. I'll just say you can certainly solve it. And here's some snapshots of the string world sheet, unfortunately plotted upside down relative to all my other pictures. So you should really do that to it. Right. And this is just showing the string hanging down between this quark and an antiquark at a relatively early time. They separate, the string world sheet hangs down further, they separate more, it hangs down further and further. And the only thing you're supposed to take away from that is that if you look at these later time configurations, if you just sort of cut that in half and looked at the late time profile there, it is exactly the same. It just sits right on top of the stationary solution. They approach the stationary solution perfectly nicely.
So can you watch it down surface? Let them go with some velocity?
Good. So you have a dial, which is that initial energy. And so if that initial energy is low enough, they'll feel an attractive Coulombic force, and they will turn around and come back. Still a dissipative system. It's not like they sit there and oscillate forever, and it's kind of nasty to actually see it numerically. But yes, you can see solutions which turn around and come back. But if the energy is high enough, and that was what this example showed, then they never turn around. They just keep moving outward, but slower and slower and slower, and just asymptotically come to rest. And you can look at the you can study the motion of the endpoints. You can compare it to that simple formula. It works beautifully. Okay.
When you stop, does it ever go back? Should it go back?
Well, again, this depends on the initial energy you start with. So if the initial energy is low enough, there are solutions which separate, reach a turning point, and turn around. All right, but if you start with enough energy, they don't do that. They just separate.
But there is a finite force between them. At the end point,
that force, so to speak, is the force being exerted by a string that's dropping very far in the geometry. And so the force on the endpoints is also going to zero as the bottom point, so to speak, of that world sheet gets closer and closer to the horizon. That's right. That's right. So, I mean, they're asymptotically coming to rest. There's no finite time in which they're at rest. Okay, if you go back and look at that formula for the friction coefficient and say what actually works, what agrees with the full time-dependent solutions, when you convert the expression in terms of velocity to the expression in terms of momentum, what really appears there is this kinetic mass. And although that's the same as the zero temperature mass in the limit of arbitrarily heavy quarks, they're substantially different, as I showed you in a plot just a moment ago, for lighter quarks. And I just want to note that if you just take these results and say, what's the smallest that kinetic mass can be, there's a very simple lower limit, which turns into a very simple upper limit on this friction coefficient. And interestingly, although everything I've talked about is heavy quarks, which really have this D7 brain outside the horizon, you are perfectly free to ask questions about semi-classical dynamics of a string representing a light quark anti-quark state. So you're perfectly free to crank the quark mass all the way down to zero. The edge of that D-brain drops into the horizon, which means the lightest energy states involving your now light quarks are arbitrarily small. But you can still say, let's start with some state that happens to be a high energy state and watch what it does. And I just want to mention that my colleague Andreas Karsch and his student Christian Jensen have been looking at this, where they start with a quark-antiquark pair connected by a little string, which in this dual description is just sitting, think of it as some point high up in this ADS geometry. The endpoints of the string are going to move apart, but there's nothing holding the endpoints of the string up anymore. They can fall in under the influence of gravity, basically. So they do. The whole string falls down, but their endpoints move apart. And you can just watch what happens, and you can say, how does the motion of the endpoints of this string behave? And you can actually compare that motion of the endpoints of the string with just the simple friction force. And it turns out that it agrees stunningly well with a value of this friction coefficient of 2 pi t. OK. I guess I'm not going to say anything about other solutions. I guess I'm. Yeah, well, a particular, I guess I wouldn't call it Charmonic, a particular high energy CC bar state that's starting off with.
This is plus and minus annihilation of the light quarks.
Yeah, that's a better way of putting it.
Was it a pair of light quarks or heavy quarks?
This was light quarks because they were free to fall.
High acceleration.
Yeah. Okay. I think in light of the time, I won't say anything about fluctuations. Any calculation like this that gives you dissipation, that's telling you about a quantum field theory, you have to say, where are the fluctuations that are inevitably part of that? In our classical string analysis, you didn't see it. subsequent work by Steve and others, I think, has really sort of given this beautiful picture of where the stochastic fluctuations that have to be present because we have a dissipative system are nicely described by fluctuations of this moving string world sheet, where you have this apparent horizon on the string world sheet and this sort of physics of Hawking radiation on the string world sheet. One can argue that in order to extract the friction coefficient, if that was your interest, you are nevertheless perfectly free to study the system in a regime where those stochastic forces are negligible and the system was very, very well modeled just by the classical dissipative friction dynamics. So let me now turn to the question that was also discussed earlier, saying we've got this system of a quark moving through a plasma. It's transferring energy to the plasma. And where is that energy going? All right, in the weakly coupled plasma, you can say all kinds of words about that, about is it collisional energy loss, is it radiative energy loss, that's all tied to having this sort of microscopic and gauge-dependent way of probing the dynamics. In the strongly coupled theory, the only thing you can do is ask decent gauge invariant questions. So in terms of how to interpret this in terms of non-abelian gauge fields and is it collisional or radiative, I have nothing to say. But what is well defined is to simply say, roll up your sleeves and calculate the energy momentum tensor in this non-equilibrium state of a moving quark. And gauge string duality gives you a clear prescription, painful but clear, on how to do it. That expectation of the energy momentum tensor is related to the variation of the gravitational action when you view it as a functional of the boundary value of the metric. So what you need to do is perturb the metric, solve the linearized gravitational equations of motion to get the on-shell action, which is then a function just of the boundary value of the metric. So, as I wrote here, if all I want is this expectation value, a one-point function, then it's sufficient to just solve the linearized gravitational fluctuation equation, but you have to do that in the ADS black hole background with this moving string as a source in the five-dimensional Einstein equations. So that linearized analysis gives you some second-order differential operator acting on a metric perturbation equals a source due to the string. And you just want to solve it. And here's my caricature of a picture Steve had, which was a little more elegant. This is sort of very similar to, you know, Jackson-style electrodynamics problems, except now we really need to solve not a linear Maxwell's equation, but a linearized Einstein equation with a source. So because there's a source, that means if you can find a Green's function, then you're going to convolute the Green's function with the source. And it's just a matter of rolling up your sleeves and doing it. And it is somewhat painful. The good news is, as long as you're only asking this question for this stationary solution, you can do a four-dimensional Fourier transform over all the Minkowski coordinates. And you can also decouple all the different components of the metric perturbation if you cleverly switch to gauge invariant linear combinations of those metric perturbations. I'm only going to focus on the energy density itself. When you Fourier transform, the wave vector picks out a preferred direction, but then there is an O2 symmetry that's just an obvious rotation symmetry around that direction, and so you can classify these gauge invariants according to their helicity around that wave vector, and all we need is the unique helicity zero gauge invariant linear combination of metric perturbations. And that's wonderful because it means instead of solving some ugly 15-coupled ordinary differential equations, now you just have one. And it's a second-order ordinary differential equations. I could write out these functions completely explicitly. It has a source on the right-hand side. You can work that out completely explicitly. And so to solve it, the most straightforward thing is to find a Green's function, which you're going to convolute against that source. Maybe we don't teach it to freshmen, but we should, that such Green's functions have a standard representation as a product of homogeneous solutions divided by a Wronskian, and which homogeneous solutions is where you plug in the appropriate boundary conditions. You want one homogeneous solution for near the boundary, which satisfies the appropriate boundary condition of just a Dirichlet boundary condition at the ADS boundary, and then on the other side, you want a homogeneous solution that satisfies your incoming boundary condition of the horizon. So all that's easy. The only thing that's non-trivial is you can't actually solve this differential equation analytically, so you can't actually write down these homogeneous solutions analytically. So what do you have to do? You have to numerically solve for these homogeneous solutions for every value of your Fourier transform for vector Q. So having found those homogeneous solutions, then you have to evaluate this radial integral numerically. And if you're interested in making a coordinate space picture, which was the problem I posed to my student Paul Chesler, then you have to do that with enough precision that you can do a Fourier transform, which is always tricky because you always have these phase oscillations. Okay. Oh, good. Because we have a stationary solution, when you Fourier transform, you get a delta function, which just says the frequency is directly related to the longitudinal wave vector. So when the dust settles, that means really this Fourier integral reduces just to a two-dimensional integral once you use that fact and the cylindrical symmetry. Okay, let me now just show you some pictures.
If you use the limits, then you use 5 minutes in this question.
Good. So here is a picture. everyone clear on that? So this is a picture showing energy density in units of square root lambda t cubed, except we've actually multiplied by a factor of just the radial position from the quark, just so you bring out structure a little better, as a function of the what I'll call the longitudinal position of the quark. The bottom line is the quark is moving this way. All right, and this is one transverse position there. And what got cut off for some reason is this is a case of the quark moving at 1/4 of the speed of light. So in this thermal system, there's a speed of sound. Because n equals 4 is conformal, we know that that's exactly 1 over square root of 3. So this is an example of subsonic motion.
So where is the quark at the point of the snapshot?
It's at the point of the snapshot, it's right at the origin, okay. Which means it's basically right under that peak.
And it's moving to the left?
And it's moving toward the left, parallel with this axis.
Why does it have energy density preceding it?
Good. So that's the first thing you notice. So it is, there's an increase in energy density in front of the quark and a deficit of energy density behind it. And I think the most natural answer to your question is to say, go boating in a small boat. Right? And you push water in front of you. Right? There's more water in front of you, and there's actually a depression in the water right behind you.
If you're a boat or a point particle, it wouldn't do it. So this says that the quark is behaving as if it has some size.
No, it will be, yeah.
And so could you fit a size and see how
it... Could we use your quark?
I would be happy with talking with you about that further in order to sort of figure out how to turn that intuition into a crisp question.
Yeah.
Larry, how heavy is that coin?
We literally made these pictures in the limit where the quark was infinitely heavy. Okay. This is much sexier. This is the same thing at a velocity of 3/4 of the speed of light. And so you see something which is a shock wave, is a Mach cone. But of course, it's not an actual sharp discontinuity. Right? A lot of discussions of shock waves and, you know, real air is carried out in approximations of an inviscid fluid, where you actually have discontinuities and properties. But this is a treatment that has correctly incorporated the microscopic physics of the theory, valid from arbitrarily large scales down to scales, well, small compared to the Compton wavelength of things going on. So in that sense, I think it's pretty amazing. And you see a finite width, which is directly related to the fact that this is a viscous fluid. It's the viscosity that smears out that shock.
So yet there is nothing behind. There is no history.
And one of the most dramatic things here is that certainly by eyeball, you just don't see much of anything going around. You notice there's still this nice depression here, right? Again, as the shock goes by you, just as you showed in cross-section, which sort of amounted to taking a slice here, you see first an increase in energy density and then a deficit as this thing moves by you.
So there you would see significant pointing vector flux right behind that quark in a diffusion wave such as human generations.
I mean, so far we've chosen to focus our attention just on energy density. We want to look at energy flux, and I have no doubt that what you said is perfectly true. On the other hand, in energy density, you know, at the eyeball level, you just don't see much.
Well, but in linearized theory, that mode is orthogonal to the energy density mode is orthogonal to the speed
Okay, and let me just show my last picture here, which is a curious borderline case of precisely v equals the speed of sound. What's amusing about that is if you say, what's the appropriate Mach angle? Well, when you go right at the speed of sound, instead of having a conical wavefront going behind you, in fact, it just becomes a plane front. So you should think of this here as sort of the smeared out version of a planar shock front that's just moving with the quark at the speed of sound. Okay, I'm running out of time. As I said, we've really just had these pictures for a very short period, but I think they look pretty. And let me just end by throwing up my list of open questions of interesting things that I hope to see progress on in the not so distant future. If I could, I'll just. Yeah, okay, so I won't say anything about these open questions. Thank you.
About the poll. If you look in the wave, are there any signs of any instabilities which could hint at possible turbulence?
I mean, through the magic of this mapping to the gravitational system, right, we have a description that's completely linear. Right? We've only ever solved linear equations. So even though the near zone is a non-hydrodynamic, in the sense that all the higher derivative terms you could imagine adding to linearized hydrodynamic are important. Nevertheless, in terms of all the additional degrees of freedom which came into this gravitational description, what you gain is it's all linear. So I don't see how we'll ever see any sign of turbulence or intermittency until you look at corrections which bring in nonlinearities. Now, of course, this was also looking at a pure stationary solution. If you look at something which is now non-stationary, it could do, you know, even in this linearized analysis, could have much richer behavior.
Well, there's one question that I never understood about this rate. So if you are moving below the speed at the speed lower than the speed of sound, there is no Markov.
Right.
If you're moving at the speed greater than the speed of sound, there is Markov, as you clearly showed.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you look at energy loss, there is absolutely no there that tells you whatsoever about this, you know, speed of sound or, you know, just a number, you know,
the sound pattern is not known.
Right. Yeah. Because it's kind of local, it doesn't know what it's doing.
No, but I mean.
You mean the drag coefficient?
Well, yeah.
So the drag coefficient doesn't show any qualitative change at that point.
Right. Yes. So that's all perfectly true, but just to sort of say it in different words, right? First of all, what I'm calling shockwave is this perfectly smooth, smeared out thing. There's no sharp distinction to saying you have a discontinuity in this region and you don't in that. Below the speed of sound, you see a disturbance in the energy density that just moves with the quark. No big deal. As you approach the speed of sound from below, you still see that disturbance that moves right with the quark. Right at the speed of sound, it's just that its shape has now deformed into that sort of funny last picture I showed you. Now you increase the velocity some more, and it's simply the shape of that disturbance that's moving with the quark now also deforms and sort of starts pulling backward and turning into something that looks like this smeared out non-color.
The strength is not changed.
No, but I'm trying to reconcile this with the physical picture. I mean, if you have a real particle that moves through the medium, at some point it starts emitting, you know, photons at the Cherenkov angle, right?
But it moves energy locally.
It moves energy
what
locally.
Happens at large distances?
A way to refine.
Okay, we're going to Uli.
This is for an infinite homogeneous medium. The real game is, of course, to do that in a heavy ion condition. We know how to do the hydro of the heavy ion condition, but we didn't get these effects because, obviously, we didn't couple the energy of the quark correctly in. You have found a way of doing that correctly to generate Markov. So my question is, can you translate what you have back into my language? Give me a source term that I put on the right-hand side of the hydro equations and then evolve them with our code, or is that in principle impossible because you're only looking at the stationary asymptotic state?
Well, I think we can give you such a source term that answers your question, at least for the case of a quark moving in an n equals 4, a strongly coupled n equals 4 plasma.
It's good enough for me at the moment.
But exactly, you can extract from this information that says what's the strength of the source that you should plug in to describe things just with straight linearized hydro.
And it's more, it has to have a space and velocity structure.
Right, right. So its Fourier transform has momentum dependence.
You just have to go to distance where hydro starts.
But it's still more than just a single.
Okay, last question, please.
I don't mean as of this instant, but are you and Steve calculating the same thing such that now as you both term results, you should be able to compare curve for curve and they should agree exactly? Are you calculating different things?
We're definitely attempting to calculate the same thing. And truth be told, at the moment, we have some discrepancies in our asymptotic behavior. And we're going to work it out. I don't know, you know, whether we made a mistake which needs to get fixed or what. It's possible. I'm absolutely certain that as certain as I can be, that the actual equations we solved were right, because both my student and I worked those out completely independently. It's not easy to do an equation by equation comparison with Steve's work just because we use different coordinates and different variables for part of it. But
these
we'll settle this.
The results are non-trivial enough that if you did a result by result comparison, it'd be very convincing.
Okay,
they
will come to that. Okay, let's thank Larry again. Dr. Bogdanek will speak about this study and others coming in the next week.